In no particular order today, global economic growth, a monastery, and those scooters that are everywhere. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 9th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are, last time I counted, somewhere north of a zillion moving parts in the global economy. You push on one, you pull on another, and things happen. The catch is that not all those moving parts are the same, right? And when you get, as we've got, some of the heavyweights pushing and shoving, the end result is not usually a net positive, which gets us to the latest global economic growth forecast from the International Monetary Fund. In a nutshell, still good, but not as good as it would have been without the aforementioned pushing and shoving and trade war. The IMF has downgraded its growth forecast this year from 3.9 to 3.7%, and next year ticked it down from 2.7 to 2.5%. Yes, not huge, but a 10% here and a 10% there, and pretty soon you're talking about real economics. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going with more on what could be dragging us down in a year's time.
The IMF isn't saying the world's economies are all going to contract, just that things are going to slow down.
Relative to where we thought we were last year, or even 6 months ago, we are right now in a, in my opinion, slightly worse place.
Jacob Kierkegaard is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute. On the one hand, the U.S. is still in the middle of a big stimulus. We got a big tax cut and more federal deficit spending. On the other hand, that kick is going to fade away. But the IMF is going further than that, says Kierkegaard.
They're basically predicting that the whole premise for the tax cuts, which was that they would stimulate private growth, the IMF is basically saying, ain't happening.
Ain't happening in the medium to long term, specifically. The Federal Reserve is also raising rates, which will be a drag on growth. But Maurice Obstfeld, director of research at the IMF, made a special point of mentioning something else that could hurt growth prospects for the U.S.
We have downgraded its 2019 growth forecast owing to the recently enacted tariffs on a wide range of imports from China and China's retaliation. China's expected 2019 growth is also marked down.
The current sugar high in the U.S. economy and stimulus in the Chinese economy are hiding a lot. When that party calms down, trade barriers and tariffs, which are growth-slowing taxes, are going to start showing up in the data, the IMF says.
Anecdotal evidence accumulates on the resulting harm to companies.
Finally, emerging markets, developing countries. They had it real rough this year and may be in for worse ahead. Matt Slaughter is the dean of the Tuck School.
History shows when the Fed tightens and if other major central banks tighten, that tends to put pressure on a lot of emerging markets.
Some last few wet blankets the IMF sees being thrown on the world economy, rising oil prices, and possibly Brexit. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Google wants you to know it takes your privacy really, really seriously and that it's really, really sorry it didn't tell anybody back in March when it figured it out about a bug that exposed personal data, and we're talking full names, emails, birth dates, and pictures too, exposed all that data from hundreds of thousands of users of Google+. It's not very successful and, as of yesterday, shut down social network. The Wall Street Journal, which reported the story, said the company kept quiet for fear of regulatory scrutiny and reputational damage, which may well be. But Marketplace's Renata Sago reports now on how privacy breaches might also hit Google where it hurts.
When the Google Plus bug surfaced in March, it was an inconvenient time to be a tech giant with a data breach on its hands. Facebook was in the middle of the Cambridge Analytica scandal and was trying to fend off new regulations. Google wanted no association with that. Matt Merzieski with the digital ad agency Merkel says Google likely feared a big hit to its reputation.
That's the value exchange. And if Google breaks that trust, then their entire ad business is at risk.
Google dominates that advertising space, and ads account for more than 80% of Google's revenue. Joshua Erdman runs the digital marketing agency Systems and Marketing Solutions. He says Google's now trying to restore trust by reworking its own privacy rules.
They're trying to take the best stance in getting caught. That's their answer to say we're handling it.
Self-correction is one way the company can skirt costly federal regulations. Google may be a powerful tech company, but Erdman says competition could get a leg up if Google gets bogged down in new regulations.
If there ends up being a problem from Google, there are going to be entrepreneurs that will have an answer and a replacement up in you know, in less than a year.
Monica Peart is Senior Forecasting Director for eMarketer. She says Google's ad revenue is growing, even as ad competitors like Amazon grab a bigger slice of the market. Still, she says, it's unlikely for this Google Plus breach to hurt the company's bottom line.
As long as Google is answering everyone's questions, then Google is still going to be used for the vast majority of searches. And that's really what advertisers have to work with.
Google says it found no evidence that the exposed personal data caused any harm. The company did not respond to an interview request. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Calm, I think, would be a good word for Wall Street today. Stocks and bonds as well for a change. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Without getting too far down in the nitty-gritty, because there was a lot going on in this economy that led to the financial crisis and the recession that followed 10 years ago, but big picture, the housing market in this country went kerflooey, and with it, all the carefully structured investments that had been built on that market went kerflooey as well. And at the bottom of all of those investments were mortgages. Mortgages issued by the millions that maybe some of them kind of shouldn't have been. Banks paid billions of dollars in fines for their part in the housing mess that hit this economy a decade ago. Bank of America alone paid nearly $17 billion for the bad stuff that it and some of the banks it bought Countrywide and Merrill Lynch for some of the stuff that they did. Of that total, $7 billion was designed for consumer relief, which the bank could pay in a bunch of different ways. It modified a lot of mortgages to try to keep people in their homes, for instance, but it did some more obscure things as well. So as part of our project on the 10 years since the crash, divided decade, we're calling it, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has part of that story.
Andre Alert is buying his first home, a single family in Schenectady, New York, with a stone front and big back deck. As soon as he walked in the door, he knew he wanted this house.
We just had this feeling like, yeah, I like this one.
He follows a home inspector into the unfinished basement.
We spend a lot of our time.
The ceiling skims Andre's head. Taller visitors will have to crouch. But he's thinking this will be his man cave.
I'm going to make full use of every space.
For several years, this house had been vacant. Its long road to recovery started with that 2014 Bank of America settlement. The bank donated the house to a national nonprofit called the National Community Stabilization Trust.
Our motto is, in effect, no single-family home, no structure left behind.
Robert Grossinger runs NCST, which received about 1,000 of the almost 1,500 properties Bank of America donated as part of this settlement. Once NCST got the house's paperwork and title in order, it transferred the home to a local organization in 2017, along with $30,000 in other settlement funding to help fix it up. That funding was important because the donated houses were in rough shape.
I would say that 100% of them were dilapidated. I would say that 30% of them were not salvageable.
Bank of America declined to comment for this story. Grossinger says sorting out what to do with each donation has been slow and messy. First off, NCST found Bank of America didn't actually own about 100 properties it tried to give them, even though Grossinger says the bank thought it did. With the rest, NCST started by trying to find homeowners to see if they wanted to stay. For about 10% of the properties, it gave the homeowner their house.
We weren't giving them $100,000 homes. We were giving them homes that were worth about $20,000.
Absent a homeowner, NCST would foreclose on the property and try and find a local nonprofit or municipality to help fix it up or tear it down. 125 properties are still in the foreclosure process. Even though the settlement was announced in 2014, Grossinger doesn't think his organization will be done dealing with these homes until late next year. So that's one thing he'd change about the settlement if he could.
I would have structured it where the mess is cleaned up first by those that made it.
The bank.
So pay the taxes, pay any outstanding liens, do property maintenance so that there's no present health and safety issues, and then you can donate them.
In some ways, donating these homes gave the bank a way to get rid of these properties and all their problems. Problems NCSD and its partner organizations had to take on. But as much work as that's been,
we want to get a homeowner in. We want the property back on the tax rolls. That's our mission.
David Hogenkamp runs the Capital Region Land Bank, part government agency, part nonprofit. It took Andre's house and three others from NCST, two teardowns and two fixer-uppers. Hogenkamp says getting new homeowners into these houses is helping revitalize hard-hit neighborhoods.
And then if we do it in a smart way, we can use the capital to take care of some of the other properties where it's, you know, it's a $50,000 demolition or it's a $30,000 just structural repair.
The $100,000 Andre is paying for his house, market rate in that Schenectady neighborhood, will go towards fixing up or tearing down other vacant homes in the area. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
A lot of things can change in 10 years, but you can make a pretty good case that the last 10 years in this economy, since the financial crisis and the recession, have changed more things for more people than any particular decade has in a good long while. How We Changed is our first-person series about what the crisis did to this economy and to the people living in it. And today, 39-year-old Razanath Das, he grew up in Mumbai, lives now in New York City.
In the 90s, India opened up its economy. I was 13 years old at that time, and one of the first things to come into India was American TV. That was the first time I saw the movie Wall Street, and I wanted to own a yellow convertible and a blue motorboat. I was very specific about the colors. So I immediately felt that, well, this is the place that I'm meant to be in. I came to the U.S., got my MBA at Cornell, and my very first interview, my interviewer was wearing a cowboy hat, and he handed me this sheet of paper which said, investment banking is a business where thieves and pimps run freely on the corridors, and the few good men die the death of a dog. My first interview question was, which one of the three are you? 2006 was an incredible year in the banking industry. Just to sign my acceptance letter was $60,000. But I had also begun to experience a certain kind of discontent, some hollowness to it. I had very good friendships in a monastery on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I found myself there over the weekends having very intellectually deep conversations with the monks. So I made the monastery my home and started living by monastic principles and working on Wall Street at the same time. I had a closet where I kept my four suits. I slept on the floor, no meat, no caffeine, no alcohol, and 2 hours of meditation every day. This was a big shock for my colleagues in the banking world. When 2007 came in, it was a big shock. We didn't know what was happening. Six rounds of layoffs in my team alone. Once you were given the news, you were not allowed to go back to your desk. All your possessions will be sent to you at home. And I remember very vividly feeling that this was so inhuman. It was carnage. It was a big wake-up call for me. It was just very, very evident that if I had a conscience, I had to make a shift. It took me about a month to put in my resignation and move into the monastery full time. The entire crisis was a success without substance. That's why it collapsed. That was the biggest lesson. Success is a result of having deeper substance, not the other way around.
Razanath Das lived in that monastery for 4 years before he launched a startup that he now runs. It's called Upbuild. It focuses on developing mindfulness. We've got some pictures of Razanath and his journey on our Instagram. We're at MarketplaceAPM. And we would love to hear your story of what the financial crisis and the Great Recession meant to you. The hashtag we're using is HowWeChanged. Coming up.
Every time they come on the sidewalk, I have to move over. I feel like they're going to run me over.
Yeah, you know why? Because they are. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial's off 56 points this Tuesday, 0.2%, 26,430. NASDAQ up 2, we'll call that flat percentage-wise, 77.38. S&P 500 down 4 points, 0.1%, 2880. American Airlines fell 6.5% today. The carrier said third quarter fuel prices were higher than expected. Other airlines also met some turbulence. Delta dipped 2.4%. United, my home for about 4 hours and 40 minutes today, gave back 2.6%. Boeing dropped a bit less than 0.1% despite an uptick last month in deliveries of its profitable 737 jetliners. Industrial stocks, usually sensitive to international trade movements, of which we are in the middle, were generally lower. Heavy equipment firm Caterpillar dug down 2.5%. Deere hammered down 0.2%. Bond prices rose just a hair. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell a corresponding hair. 3.20% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hurricane Michael set to hit the northeast Gulf Coast of Florida tomorrow, probably the seventh hurricane of the season. Storms like this, of course, often mean lost power, and lost power, if you run a power company, is a bad thing. It's a bad thing on a long list of other worries, I should add, like moving over to renewables, also what technology can mean for big energy. Lynn Good is the CEO of Duke Energy. She's got about 7.5 million customers in the Southeast and Midwest. So, yes, hurricanes and storms and all that stuff are a big deal for her. Lynn Good, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about some of the things you're I would imagine, worried about. Number one, obviously, would be the sustainability and reliability of the power grid, right?
Absolutely. The power grid is what I would call it, Kai, is the lifeblood. It is the part of the energy value chain that ensures that we're delivering energy and it's arriving at homes and businesses in a reliable way.
How satisfied are you that it is reliable and robust?
It is a reliable and affordable infrastructure today, but as we talk about transformation, just like any form of infrastructure, we need to keep investing.
Talk to me for a second, would you, about corporate America's role, and I guess your slice of it in particular, in... So this is going to sound dicey, but I'm going to go with it. In forcing American consumers to understand the challenges of climate change and acting on it. I'm thinking now specifically of the Nobel Prizes yesterday, obviously, and the climate change report.
You know, Kai, I would share with you that I believe consumers are very informed. And if I look at the track record that we've demonstrated, carbon emissions are down 30% at Duke Energy, headed to 40%. And we believe that ongoing discussion with our customers on how to get there in a balanced way over a period of time is something that we find our customers to be very interested in.
What does a balanced way mean? Is that you're trying to find your way between coal and natural gas and solar and all that? Is that what that means?
You know, our goal is to increase the amount of renewables on our system, never compromising. So it's wind, it's solar, it's battery technology, it's natural gas. For Duke, it's also nuclear. And for many companies around the U.S., it's nuclear. This industry has never been an industry that pursues a single technology. And I think that has been important for us to maintain affordability and reliability. And as we sit here today, I'm, you know, giving you a list of the resources that we are investing in. But if we think 10 years from now, there's going to be more because we're also a believer in research and development to bring more technologies to the table. And let's allow room for those investments to occur when they're economic.
What's your single biggest challenge?
I would say keeping pace with any industry going through transformation. Are we moving fast enough? Do we have the skills? And I think that's a challenge for any business, particularly a legacy one like ours, that we are moving quickly enough to accomplish what we believe is important for customers.
You know, it's funny to hear you talk about speed, because that is an ever-present issue in this economy. And it makes sense when you're thinking about, you know, like Facebook or Snapchat or, you know, any of those others. But the idea that a power company is worried about that is sort of interesting.
Well, Kai, I think the issue on speed is one of, you know, it's not in the next moment am I making the right decisions, right. But it is, I'm making decisions today that'll be important in 2025 and 2030 and 2035. So I want to make sure that I've got a clear vision of where we're going so that as we invest, we are moving to where we believe the requirements of customers will be over that time frame.
Huh. All right. So let me try something with you that I haven't done in a long time, but I figure I'll give it a whack and we'll see how it goes. What is your job in five words or less?
Serve customers, inspire employees,
nice.
Drive excellence.
Oh, no, you had it.
Five,
you had
six.
It. Oh, my goodness. Oh, well, you know, all right. It was close. You did better than a lot of people. I'll tell you that. Lynn Good, she is the chairman and CEO of Duke Energy. Lynn, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, show of hands on this one. Those dockless electric scooters that are becoming ever more popular, are they a fun, green way to get people out of their cars? Show of hands, please. Or are they a dangerous, unsightly menace? It's only been about a year, maybe a little bit more, since those things began buzzing around, and feelings pro and con run deep. But as Megan McCarty-Carino reports from KPCC in Los Angeles, this is not the first time new technology has disrupted the streets.
You can barely hear them as they whiz by, but the outcry over e-scooters has been loud.
I'm totally against it. They litter the sidewalk.
Every time they come on the sidewalk, I have to move over. I feel like they're going to run me over.
Just a sampling of opinions from Aldo and Denise Mimoun in the beachside city of Santa Monica. Recently, officials agreed to allow as many as 2,000 scooters on their streets. But as cities struggle to deal with this addition to the urban landscape, the horror stories and the anger haven't let up. There's even Instagram accounts of people destroying the scooters, running them over with cars, dropping them off tall buildings. It's gotten intense. Historian Peter Norton says he's seen it before.
It's a new version of an old problem.
Norton is a professor at the University of Virginia, and he wrote a book about what happened when another new innovation, the automobile, arrived on city streets.
The predominant reaction among most people was, we have to restrict these crazy drivers and their machines.
See, before cars came along, our streets were really different. They were full of people walking, playing, biking, riding horses, pushing carts, getting on and off streetcars, and they were all jostling for the same space in a kind of chaotic ballet. But then cars came along. They're big, they're fast, they're made of metal, and they were killing people by the thousands.
More autos meant, alas, more accidents.
News of the day was filled with grisly stories of crashes and cartoons of evil drivers depicted as grim reapers. But then, things changed. Car proponents campaigned to shift the conversation from deadly drivers to careless pedestrians. It was the beginning of jaywalking.
Jay, in old slang, was a foolish person from the country. We would call them a hick. It's an offensive term.
The aim was to shame pedestrians for walking into the streets, which the automobile backers wanted cars to own. One of the first cities to make jaywalking a crime was Los Angeles. By the 1920s, the fast-growing city had one of the highest car ownership rates in the country, and drivers wielded their influence through the powerful Auto Club. Yeah, the same one you call to jump your car battery.
We represented the motorists, and we wanted to make sure that the streets were safe and that everyone knew what to do.
Matthew Roth is the group's historian. He says the Auto Club did much more than promote laws to discourage jaywalking.
Everything from signs to lane marks to traffic signals, all of these common sense rules had to be derived and then disseminated and then enforced.
The Auto Club worked hand-in-hand with the city to do that and turned the street in front of their historic headquarters south of downtown into a kind of testing ground for new ideas, like one of the first traffic signals.
You know, it had a concrete base and it rose up 14 feet with signals to go or stop.
Standing at that intersection today, you can see the legacy of those efforts. A street that is much more ordered than the old days, but also more dominated by cars. Norton, the historian, says that may not last.
The victory of automobiles in the 1920s is proof that what streets are for can be changed.
Innovation, he says, is a powerful force.
The popularity of scootering is actually, I think, pretty good evidence that people are looking for something different. And if we, in 2018, take the same kind of approach of reexamining our laws, our social norms, and our infrastructure, we can reinvent streets again. And there's no reason why we shouldn't.
Like it or not, e-scooters could someday become just another part of our streetscape. In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, some economic insight perhaps into the big non-economic story of the day. Nikki Haley announcing she's going to step down as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations by the end of the year. Haley pointed out to the president in her resignation letter that she has been in public office between the U.N. and South Carolina for 14 years now. Not mentioned was that as of her last financial disclosure statement, Ambassador Haley has at least $1.5 million in debt. Part of that is for her mortgage, we should say. The ambassador to the United Nations, by the way, makes $180,000 a year. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 56 points today, about 0.2%. NASDAQ basically flat. The S&P 500 slipped 4 points. That's a 0.1% on that particular index. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.